Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us. This week is episode 26 of our Disney Bracket. Today we will be discussing 1991's Beauty and the Beast, along with 2000's Dinosaur.
If you hear any horns in the background, that's not a train that we didn't bother to cut out. That's just the Allosaur migration.
They're iguanodons.
That's what I said.
Also, before we go any further, we're going to be talking about Gaston and some of the unsavory aspects of him. So if you don't want to deal with that right now, probably come back to this episode a little bit later. But let's talk about how these two films got here.
So, Beauty and the Beast went up against Mulan. Very similar mashup.
It was so hard to see those two go up against each other in round one.
Right.
That was probably our first really difficult match.
Because they're both movies that I'd want to keep watching. Like, they're both very watchable.
And I think, really, it came down to...
I've seen Chicken Little more than I've seen Mulan this year.
That is a travesty.
I've seen Chicken Little more than I've seen my grandmother this year.
I think, really, in that mashup, it came down to... You have a American company run by white people adapting a traditional Chinese folktale. And there are unavoidable issues. It doesn't matter how many actors of Asian descent that you cast for the voice roles. It's still going to be whitewashed in some aspect. And I think that's kind of why we moved Beauty and the Beast over that.
And then it went up against Jungle Book, which, similar problems, but more.
Yeah, in general, Jungle Book is a much weaker film.
And it's not like Beauty and the Beast doesn't have things to recommend. It's not just coasting on its laurels. Incredible music, some really cool animation, great characters, good dialogue.
There's a lot to love for Beauty and the Beast. And like, we talked a lot about that for Mulan, and it kind of just edged that out. Whereas with Jungle Book, it was much more of, this is where things were right before Walt Disney had passed and was no longer a part of the company, to probably right around Disney hitting its peak during the 90s. But on the other hand, we also have Dinosaur.
How did we get here, Kronk?
I don't know. By all means, it doesn't make any sense.
I mean, partially went up against Peter Pan.
Probably the most racist film on this bracket.
And then the uncomfortable sexism, which was, you know, definitely part of the time, but has super not aged well.
I understand why people love that story, but unfortunately, the Disney adaptation is not very watchable in this day and age. If you want that Peter Pan fix, just go watch Hook. It's really good.
Yes, thank you. And then Dinosaur went up against Sleeping Beauty. And I have a special place in my heart for Sleeping Beauty. Like, I love it a lot, but I also love Dinosaur a lot. And you were less fond of Sleeping Beauty than I was. And I think that kind of helped a lot.
Like, I know there's a lot of people out there who love Sleeping Beauty, but there are very few parts of that film that I can really enjoy. The middle is just kind of all over the place, and there's not really lots going on. I think if we had a bit more Maleficent throughout the tale, and it didn't have those very weird artistic choices that I have issues with, it might be Sleeping Beauty going up against Beauty and the Beast here. But that's not this universe.
And that probably would have made a lot more sense than Beauty and the Beast versus Dinosaur.
Yeah, but we've had some wonderful memes come out of it.
So let's talk about these two movies without any further ado. I try not to be too cinema-sinzy in life in general, but especially on this podcast, but I will admit that having watched Beauty and the Beast 3 times now, it's harder and harder to hold back the floodgates there.
I'm with you there.
You know, it's a fairy tale and it's a fantasy, so there's a lot of stuff I can excuse there. That's fine by me. But, like, for me this time, a lot of Belle's desire to be elsewhere felt disingenuous.
Thank you!
So, Belle's whole thing is that she wants more than her provincial life, but her nose is stuck in a book, so she doesn't see the world around her, which is brimming with stuff. You've got people haggling over a giant fish in the middle of France with a cat hanging off it. You've got a man trying to seduce another woman while his wife is right behind him.
Bonjour!
Good day!
Who is your wife?
You've got all these interesting stories going on that she's not paying attention to.
Yeah, she's not really even working towards going out into adventure. She's mostly reading fiction. I could understand if she's, like, reading nonfiction. Like, here's a book about sword fighting or how to survive out in the wild or other things like that. But she wants this life of adventure that she's not really working towards at all.
And there is apparently a fair a day at most away. And I'm confused why she doesn't go to that. That sounds like more of an adventure than staying home doing nothing.
You can go with your dad so you don't have to travel alone.
Which, understandable worry. I think a part of it is just the text and and the presentation not matching, because if the bookstore wasn't chock full of books, meaning that it's having enough business to probably get by and therefore there's probably other readers in town, it doesn't match?
I think it would have worked better if the bookstore owner was like a traveling merchant and like had a cart full of books that he maybe came by like once a week or once every 2 weeks. And so Belle finishes a book in like a day and she either has to find something else to do or just keep rereading that book until he comes by again.
Right. And also that would tie into the whole themes of adventure in the Great Wide Somewhere, that he's bringing the adventure to her small provincial town. It's one of the things that live action one does really well, actually, I think. The guy seems to be a bookseller as a kind of second hobby, whereas his main job is carpentry, I think. It's just like a single shelf of books.
Mm-hmm.
And that conveys the idea a lot better. I don't want to like poo-poo anybody who like gets a lot out of this bookish character, this person who is probably really relatable if you were the bookworm in your class and you didn't have people to share that with. That's totally understandable why this would fit in. This isn't me criticizing the idea of the character, more the
execution.
Exactly.
I completely get that. I think there's some sort of disconnect going on between what they want us to perceive Belle as and what the song is trying to portray Belle as, and I just think there's this unresolved tension there.
This is kind of a weird pull, and I'm not sure if anybody's going to recognize it, but there's a Britcom where there's a recurring gag. There's a character sitting in a bar who keeps complaining about being the only gay in the village.
As I was just saying to Ma Van Wee, it's such a shame I am the only gay in this village.
Oh, I'm a gay.
I don't think so.
No, I bloody am, you know.
While every scene with them is some other gay character coming in to also be another gay in the village. And that's kind of the vibe I got off of Belle this watch through.
To be fair, the townsfolk are also kind of shitty. A lot of them complained that Belle has her head in the clouds or like her nose in a book, but they themselves, while they're singing that song, are getting distracted talking about and watching her. Like, they talk about how she doesn't fit in, but she's friendly with everyone she talks to in the morning, and she says bonjour, she tries to start a conversation, but everyone else is too busy to bother with it.
Good morning, Belle.
Morning, monsieur.
Where are you off to?
The bookshop. I just finished the most wonderful story about a beanstalk and an ogre and
that's nice. Marie! The baguettes! Hurry up!
She's trying. It's not her fault that you guys are being dicks.
The film kind of has a very cynical look at society, really. That's kind of a thing I pick up on more and more every time I watch this.
Which is the exact opposite of the outlook Dinosaur has.
Yeah, it's a thing I really like about it, that it kind of has this, people are generally pretty okay, it's just like they occasionally get mean when the chips are down, and there's a few bad actors among them making things worse.
My wife is currently getting her master's in leadership studies, so Kron is like the perfect example of toxic leadership, and at this point, that's all I can see when I look at him.
Right? I know she's having trouble trying to condense all of her notes into just 7 pages of that essay. Is there still time to write an essay on Dinosaur?
I don't think it was on the approved films list.
Well, neither was Dragonheart 4, and I still wrote that essay. And especially in today's political climate, that's kind of a message I needed right now, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't help thinking of Anna Maria Archila and Maria Gallagher yelling at Jeff Flake in an elevator as being relatively comparable to Aladar et al. Yelling at the Carnosaur at the climax.
The one big theme of Dinosaur is the community versus the survival of the fittest mentality. It's there everywhere. That's one of the reasons why we have 20 minutes of setup of Aladar on the island, is to show how he lives in this communal structure with these lemurs and how that influences his worldview and why that is different from all these dinosaurs on the mainland who have to worry about these apex predators. I get that set up, I get why it's important, but I don't think it needs to take 20 minutes. We're already a third of the way into the movie before Aladar has any sort of goal of getting to the nesting grounds. And I think that's my biggest complaint with this film, is the first half of the film feels so slow and so padded with nothing. The film doesn't really even begin proper until the scene at the lake.
Like with the like press water?
Yeah.
Thing? Really? I figure it at least starts with a fireball.
Really, the fireball is only there to get Aladar off the island. That's the only purpose it's there. It's to get him from this isolated place that the movie put him there to begin with. We don't get a goal until they come across the herd and they're moving to the nesting grounds. But before then, there's only spurts of dialogue interlaced with a few really dusty action sequences or montages of people walking. Worse than Lord of the Rings.
Although Aladar's arc and Nira's arc starts a bit before that, when we get the...
Jerkosaurus scene.
The Jerkosaurus scene, yeah. And you kind of need to set up why Aladar is different before then. So we do need a bit of that prologue. Not as much of the prologue as we get, definitely, but...
Yeah. I'm not saying that you can cut out that entire portion of the movie. I'm just saying you can probably truncate the first 40 minutes down to 15.
Probably. I do appreciate that some of the stuff is just like, here, look at this very beautiful world. Oh, it's sad that it's gone now. Prevents it from being kind of this, like, bleak, like, there's no good in the world thing.
Yeah, yeah. And... I get that. It's very obviously from this perspective of back in 2000, this was very new and there was a lot of spectacle involved when just making this movie. Nearly 20 years later, it's not all that interesting.
It's weird to me that the animation in Dinosaur is, if not always great, at least noticeably better than Chicken Little, which came out 5 years later. To be fair, different like production teams, but it's still kind of sad they stepped down from that.
Well, I mean, the big reason that The Secret Lamb got shuttered is Disney wasn't willing to pay that much for computer-generated animation at the time. And then they see what skimping out gets you in Chicken Little.
It's a learning process for everybody.
Except the people who lost their jobs.
Yeah. I think the first time watching it in a while, when you're not looking as critically, it's a little more fun. The third time this year, it's a little bit, but... The stirring music and the sweeping of the Pteranodon is still like, oh, this is lovely.
Yeah, and I will admit, there's probably a lot of that going on. This is the third time I've seen this film in 6 months.
Right. This is a good movie. I'm not sure if it's a 3 or 4 times a year movie.
Yeah, maybe once every couple of years.
Yeah, that's about right. Every 2 Octobers, right before you vote.
But it's not like Dinosaur is the only film here with some dated animation. I think what puts it into perspective the best is if you're watching a version of the film that has Human Again, and you can compare the new animations for that song with the animations in the original film, and there are parts of Beauty and the Beast that do not hold up very well at all. Honestly, there are parts of this film that look like clip art. Unfortunately, one of those is like the title card.
Yeah, what's up with that?
It's really bad. Like, I know they're going for this stone texture on And the Beast, but it looks bad.
And that's the kind of thing you can very easily retouch, because, I mean, if you're watching a Human Again version, you're watching the special edition version, the, you know, more recent one, and that's not a hard thing to do. You can remaster that. It wouldn't take long. I could do it in Photoshop.
Although, surprisingly, the scene in the ballroom where pretty much all of that is computer rendered, it honestly doesn't look that bad.
Oh, yeah. You can tell that's kind of where they put their money, which, good choice, yeah. Put it where it counts.
Yeah, there and every time we're looking at the Beast's face, that's where all the animation money went. I don't think that was a poor decision, but no, the ballroom scene looks really great. And the film would not work as well if we didn't have the amazing facial animations on the Beast.
Mm-hmm. And that's bolstered a lot by Ronnie Benson's amazing delivery as the Beast. I think I noticed that's interesting to me is he kind of stutters sometimes. Like when he's inviting Belle to her room and he says,
You want to stay in the tower?
No.
Then follow me.
It feels like the character's delivering the line, not some actor in a sound booth.
Exactly.
Ronnie Benson's line delivery here, plus the wonderful animations, are what sell the Beast. There's this harshness to the Beast, but you can both see and hear that down deep, he's very unsure of himself. He's nervous, and he doesn't know what to do. He's in this very stressful situation, and he doesn't know how to get out of it, and he's kind of panicking and he's lashing out.
He's a little scared, neither one prepared. Sorry. Honestly, the Beast might be one of my favorite characters in the Disney Renaissance. Like, just, he has layers, he has a complex arc, he, you know, the animation, the acting are good.
It's also a redemption arc, and who doesn't love that?
Right.
There's also just this really interesting thing, like, throughout the film, as the Beast acts more human and more polite, the bestial facial features that he has soften, and you can see more and more of the prince peeking out.
My favorite scene in the film is where Belle and the Beast are having oatmeal or gruel or whatever.
It's oatmeal.
Yeah, the white stuff. that, we're gonna cut that bit. And Belle uses the spoon, Beast dies in with his face, then he realizes, oh, this is... impolite. Spoon can't make it work, doesn't work with his body, and they meet in the middle where they both pick it up and sip it like a really flat cup. And I think that's a really beautiful illustration of how they're both willing to to be flexible for each other. That's really good.
Although there is one thing that I do have to complain about for the Beast. I think that the voice change between the Beast and the Prince is much too drastic. Mm-hmm. I actually thought it was a completely different voice actor at first.
I've never felt this way about anyone. I want to do something for her.
Belle, it's me.
I think the internet has basically collectively agreed that we really kind of wish the Beast stayed the Beast. Like, the Adam form or whatever is, like, not necessarily better, and the voice isn't better.
Maybe just make him a little hairier.
How would you feel about growing a beard?
I think they went too far to prettying him up.
Yeah. We could have, like, a sort of broad, fuzzy Beast.
Yeah.
Sorry, broad, fuzzy Adam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really sad he's not called Peter, because that sounds pretty close to bête, which is like the French word for beast, and that would have been a cool like wordplay thing.
Mm.
Speaking of clever wordplay, here's a riddle to guess if you can. Who is the better ambiguously gay duo? Cogsworth and Lumiere or Baleen and Yima?
I've really got to go with Baleen and Yima.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. I find them much more convincing as a gay couple. Cogsworth is so cold and distant from pretty much everyone, and Lumiere is willing to romance anything that moves.
Mm.
They feel more like mismatched buddy cops, whereas Yima and Baleen feel more like they're an old lesbian couple.
So I meant it more in the, like, who's a better comedy duo way, but you're right. Like, I ship that more.
Comedy duo, I guess Lumiere and Cogsworth, like, better comedy, but I think that's mostly because they work better individually. I don't feel like a lot of their comedy comes from playing off of each other.
You're right. They're both two funny people who are in the same space, as opposed to Baleen and Yima, where Baleen will say something kind of gentle and kind, and Yima will retort with, "Nope, leave him, let him die."
Oh, this pushing and shoving about just for a place to sleep. I'm not used to this kind of behavior.
Baleen, you got big feet, just give him a kick.
Pretty much.
Whereas Lumiere has that kind of traditional body French humor, and Cogsworth has that traditional British upper class wit, the...
Well, there's the usual things, flowers, chocolates, promises you don't intend to keep.
No.
Watching this film almost 30 years on, it has quite a bit to say about heterosexual romance, and I don't think it's aged all that well.
Extrapolate. I don't... This is an area in which I have rarely dabbled.
Part of it is, like, people love to talk about how feminist Belle is as a Disney princess, but there's a lot of men in the film who, their first instinct is to comment about how Belle looks, how pretty she is. Even Chip does it. I think probably the best example of this is Gaston talking about...
She's the one! The lucky girl I'm going to marry.
But she...
The most beautiful girl in town.
I know, Belle!
That makes her the best. And don't I deserve the best?
Well, of course,
I mean, that Belle is pretty aware of where Gaston's coming from and is taking it with aplomb. Like, she's annoyed by him, but also a little bit amused. Kind of the way I am whenever people have awful people on their Facebook. Their conversation in the cabin is Gaston is still that, like, icky, predatory, invasive person, but Belle's witty retorts are also pretty good.
Gaston's even described as a brute by his admirers.
Yeah.
Credited as the Bimbettes. There's a lot of ways where this movie is trying to be progressive, but it, in this day and age, it comes off as quote-unquote 90s progressive.
And that was enough for some people, and that's brought them to bigger and better things. And I think if Disney had a chance to, like, redo this movie and rework some of the feminist aspects to be a little stronger, that would be a really cool idea. Hope they do that at some point. Instead of making Gaston a reasonable romantic interest.
And giving him PTSD, and that's the cause of all the problems.
Yep. Belle, you should marry me. We're the only two weirdos in this town. Sorry, we're not... This is not the complaint about the Beauty and the Beast live action hour, but it could be.
Like, I will give Beauty and the Beast credit for being a stepping stone as far as that sort of progress, but at this point, it's about 3 or 4 stones behind.
Yeah. Speaking of stones and feminism, as always, I love that bit where they've got to the end of the cave, where Aladar's given up and he says...
Survive.
And he says,
"Oh, yes, we were. We're here, aren't we? And how dare you waste that good fortune by simply giving up? Shame on you. Shame on you. Shame on you. The worst of it is, you allowed an old fool like me to believe I was needed, that I still had a purpose. And Do you know what? You were right. I'm going to go on believing it. I, for one, am not willing to die here.
It's such a good speech, and again, I love that an older woman gets to give this kind of speech and have this action moments in a film that rarely happens.
The, no, we are not losing hope, we are making it through this thing, get your butt back over there, we're making it through that wall.
I love that her atypical size, in comparison to everybody else, lets her do that, and is an asset, not an inconvenience. It's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Penny is so good.
She is.
Also good, just a quick thing, a small monogram, I suppose. I really like how the dinosaurs fight in that movie. The animators clearly put in the thought of, okay, how would these creatures with these bodies do damage to each other? Like, there's use of tails, claws, shoving.
Lots of headbutts.
Lots of headbutts. Lots of rearing back, knocking over to put a person in a vulnerable position with the underbelly.
That is one thing I do appreciate. The animators seem to have done their homework. It's not that these animals move weirdly, with probably the exception of their mouths and lips, but sure. That's, you know, it's a talking animal movie that comes with the territory.
Right. I mean, it's less weird looking than, like, talking clocks and things, so it's fine. Although, speaking of some unusual animation, the transformation animation, while we complained about Beast turning into the human form, the animation for his hands and feet changing back is superb.
The morphing anatomy, I agree with you. I don't get the rays of light emanating from his fingers and toes.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I feel like they're like, well, it's got a glow, magic glows. Put it there. It's like some comes from the fingers, some just like comes from like the lifeline, the fate line. His mount of Venus is glowing. Oh, but speaking of light and glowing things, a bit I love that I never noticed before is when Belle's in the town and she shouts,
"My father's not crazy, and I can prove it."
She looks in the mirror and
"Show me the beast."
And turns around and points at that Gaston. Which, I mean, you know, sure, showing the beast because it's magical, but it's still like a fun, like, Gaston would be the one in the mirror if it wasn't magical.
Yeah.
Because he's the beast, you see.
I do really love how much fun the film is having with pointing out how Gaston is much more beastly than even the beast is. Mm. And that much it gets right. And that's pretty much one of the major themes of this film, is how you can't force a relationship with someone.
Right.
At the beginning, that's what Beast is attempting to do, and you see how well that's going for him.
Yeah.
He has to get mauled by wolves to learn, okay, maybe try something different.
And I like that all those heads on the wall that Gaston has in the tavern, all the antlers for his decorating, have probably slightly depopulated the forest, meaning the wolves are going to go after things like beasts and humans instead of just deer.
It's always bugged me that in the climax of the film, Gaston switches to a bow as opposed to his iconic blunderbuss.
Right.
And I get why Disney did it. They weren't willing to show Gaston shooting another sentient being with a gun.
Yeah.
But it makes no sense. We've never seen Gaston use a bow before this. The hunting knife makes sense, but I really hate the bow.
There's a lot of stuff about Gaston that doesn't make a lot of sense. Question, do you think Gaston has read Shakespeare?
No, Gaston doesn't read books without pictures.
And yet, during the Kill the Beast song, he quotes Macbeth. Like, he says,
"Screw your courage to the sticking place."
What? Why is that? How did that get there?
"If we should fail,
screw your courage to the sticking place, and we'll not fail."
You gotta toss those rhymes somehow.
Sure.
This is a man who also just swallows eggs whole with the shell on. I want to know more about the Enchantress.
Oh, well, if you watch the live-action movie.
Oh, really? They did go into that? How well did that work?
Well, Gaston's saying,
"You'd hang your accusations on the testimony of a filthy hag. No offense, Agatha."
And it's like, wow, she's right there, dude. They don't know she's the Enchantress or whatever.
Well, obviously not.
Yeah. She doesn't do anything about it. She doesn't care about defending the rights of women, just punishing the rich, I guess.
God damn it. I mean, you have this really interesting magical character that is just used as a plot device in Beauty and the Beast, and like, I'm surprised that she doesn't show up or anything to help Belle in her time of need.
I think she works a lot better in the animated version, where she's a triggering event that is nowhere in the narrative, because then she's more like a force of nature than a character who has to have an arc or characterization. I think that is less messy for the plot overall. She doesn't have to, like, make friends with Maurice in the woods and heal him from his wounds.
I get that. that, but considering that the live action version went down the, oh, let's give you backstory on Belle's mom and the plague.
No!
Yes!
Probably could have spent more time doing interesting stuff like the Enchantress.
Yeah. You're not wrong. Again, this is not the shit-talking live action Beauty and the Beast hour, although maybe it could be. You know what it is a good thing to talk about? Let's talk about all the good shot compositions in Dinosaur. While the animation is a bit hit and miss, they definitely did a really good job setting up really beautiful frames. Characters moving, characters of various sizes in the same frame at once, these beautiful environments the characters are moving through. I really love the way that light comes through in that cave scene I mentioned earlier, where you have this very bright beam of light through the tiny hole, and then when they break through, the previously dark screen just floods with gold and white, and it's a little bit jarring if you had your light off in your room and you only have the screen to illuminate it, and you're like, oh god, I regret this.
Beauty and the Beast also has some really lovely backgrounds and landscapes, especially during the opening song with Belle towards the end, where she's running through the fields and all that sort of stuff, but also as Maurice is heading to the fair, riding Philippe with the cart, and like they just pass through this French countryside and it looks so gorgeous.
And the castle feels like a very real place despite, you know, being hyper fantastical.
I will agree with you on the inside of the castle. The outside of the castle, they hired a very drunk architect.
To be fair, it is enchanted.
Fair.
I mean, I don't know if it gets any better after it gets de-enchanted, but maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And the weirdness of the castle's architecture kind of plays into the slight horror movie vibe that the film has going on. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, we definitely talked about how the film felt a little gothic last time we were discussing it, and that definitely feeds into that. So one nitpicky thing that is going to be very CinemaSinsy, but we're around thing, I feel fine calling it out here. They do a terrible job of conveying that Chip escapes into Belle's bag when she leaves the castle to go help her father. Like, he sneaks out of the room, and then literally the next scene is Belle on horseback going across the bridge out of the castle. Chip shows up in her bag back at their home with Maurice, and I had to go back. I'm like, did I miss something? Where the hell did he come from?
That might have been a later addition. They might have realized, oh, we need something to get Belle out of this cellar, and Chip could fit.
Yeah.
Which, it's not a bad patch, but you're right, it could have been integrated better. Kind of like how the distance of the castle is
nebulous.
I had a theory on that. As the time before the petal falls, it gets closer and closer, the castle is actually moving towards the town, and if Belle hadn't saved the beast when she did, it would have just eaten it whole.
I don't know. I mean, it would fall in with Enchantress's penchant for punishing people who didn't do anything.
Earlier I said that the movie has kind of a cynical worldview. I guess the servants in the castle are good people despite their lot in life, and they're not jerks despite all that's happened to them. So I guess it's not entirely. It's mostly just this one village of jerks, and everybody else is okay.
Those people need to, like, have a real look at themselves.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of sad that we don't really see what happens after the big fight. Like, that seems like it would create social stress for this person who's come back to princehood.
Another weird thing. I don't understand what's going on through Beast's head when he finds Maurice being comforted by his servants. Denying hospitality is what got him in this mess in the first place.
I actually kind of like his lines there. I agree that he's in the wrong head with this, but I think that's kind of, you know, part of the plot.
Fair enough.
Where he doesn't say, like, oh, you invaded.
I'm sorry.
What are you staring at?
Nothing.
So, you've come to stare at the beast, have you?
And I like that his basically first line is, I am concerned about my appearance to a greater extent than I am concerned about common sense and laws of hospitality. That is good characterization for where he's at in life.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense for someone greatly emotionally stunted as a young adolescent.
He's kind of in that same Quasimodo place of, like, you know, no face as hideous as mine was ever meant for French peasants, but more self-inflicted. And like that comes back at the end when the thing that makes him jump out at Gaston is Gaston saying,
did you honestly think she'd want you when she had someone like me?
Although it's a little weird, like, we have Beast kind of acting as this petulant child towards the beginning, but the way that they frame the dispute over whether Belle's coming to dinner or not, it definitely feels like Beast is playing the role of a parent and then Belle is playing the role of an unruly child. It feels completely off. Like, I know that the film is trying to get you to not hate the Beast and, like, understand where he's coming from, but I think they went way too far in the other direction, and it's like, no, Beast is being completely reasonable. Why won't she just come to dinner?
It doesn't help that we don't really have a good mark on how old the Beast is at that point. Like, we kind of figure it out over time, and we see it at the end, but then the Beast could be anywhere between, like, 20 and 50, and it wouldn't be the first time that Disney had a narrative about a shitty parent figure locking someone in a tower. How many times does that happen? Just quick flip through. How many times does that happen? You've got Cinderella, Snow White,
Frozen,
Sleeping Beauty, Tangled later on.
I can't think of any more off the top of my head.
One last thing. Why doesn't Belle know Beast's name? I know it doesn't really matter, but it's weird that, I mean, she's like, I've got to tell the Beast.
Yeah, you'd think that he would have shared his name with her during the There's Something There That Wasn't There Before song.
And it'd actually be a really good scene if you know, she just kept calling him Beast, like, I have a name, you know? Oh, what's your name? Eugene Fitzherbert.
I'm ready to make my decision.
I'm not. There are about equal amounts of things in these movies for me to like and dislike, so I leave this entirely in your hands.
In that case, Beauty and the Beast is moving forward, and Dinosaur finally goes extinct.
Oh, you had to put it like that, did you?
Yes, it's funny because...
Kind of Phil Tippett.
For me, I think the rose-colored glasses finally came off this week. This was a complaint-heavy episode, but my biggest complaint for With Dinosaur is just there's not enough movie for that hour and 20-minute runtime. You've got a good 40 to 50 minutes of actual content, and then there's just a lot of padding. I like the story, but I don't think that it's worth sitting through that length of time three times in 6 months for.
You've now seen 4.5 hours of Dinosaur.
Yes. I still haven't seen any of the Jurassic Worlds either. So.
Oh, man. Okay, we're stopping this podcast so we can watch Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, a soft Dracula reboot.
Mm-hmm. We are now halfway through the quarterfinals, which means we've got Moana and now Beauty and the Beast heading on to the semis. Anyway, on the docket for next week, we have 101 Dalmatians versus Lilo and Stitch.
Oh boy.
Yeah, both of those films we've fawned over for most of this bracket for very different reasons.
Yeah.
This is going to be a tough decision.
Thanks for tuning in. We don't tune in. We're not on a radio. We're not in a car. That's not how things work anymore. Does anybody actually listen to the radio? Anyway, maul that like button. eat the subscribe button in front of your family.
Once again, thank you for listening to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. Make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook. You can also follow us right here on Podbean. And we hope you listen to us again next week. This has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast.